Hello and welcome to Hanks for the Memories. You've got a friend in us. This is episode 14, Big, from 1988. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And this, so Mike, I was saying before we started recording, before we introduce our two guests, that it's not like it's a lot of work, but before we started either podcast, this and the Tom Cruise podcast, I went through and I pulled out all of their Golden Globe and Academy Award nominations, and I put them in the spreadsheet, and I was like, when we get close to these, I'm going to be like, look, the next movie's a big one. Tom Hanks nominated for Oscar. I have not been saying that because I'm not good at this.
You know, that's okay.
However, he was nominated for an Academy Award for this movie, did not win, lost to Dustin Hoffman in a film called Rain Man, which we covered on another podcast. This is also nominated for Best Original Screenplay, which also lost to Rain Man. I feel like the circle is sort of closing, or like things are linking together in the Tom Club, as it were, because of the crossover overlap here.
Yeah, worlds are colliding.
With us today to talk about this movie, we have a return champion to the Hanks for the Memories podcast, Mr. Walt Hickey. Hello, Walt.
Hello, how's it going, y'all?
Very well. Thank you for joining us for this movie.
I'm really excited.
Also with us today is a returning champion from other podcasts of ours. First time in the Tom Club, we have Miss Holly Gore. Hello, Holly.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you for being here as well. So I think that this was, I don't have the exact specifics, but I feel like of all the movies that people, you know, when we put out our call for submissions, as it were, and see which movies our friends want to do on the show, it feels like this was one of the big ones. Like, everybody wanted to do this movie, and I think for good reason.
It was one of the what ones?
I'm just going to keep laughing all episode in the background because we're going to just say Big so much.
Oh, big, big, big. But here's a stunning turn of events. I don't know if I had ever seen this movie in its entirety before today.
Whoa. Wow.
I've never seen this movie before today.
Wow. Okay. So that's two of us. All right. All right.
Well, I had never known that there was a 2-hour extended cut of this movie until today.
Holly, which one did you wind up watching? The extended or the regular?
So I ended up watching the regular because it was available on demand on my TV and I could buy it with one click.
Gotcha. Okay. And Walt, you said that you watched the regular as well, right?
I totally watched the theatrical cut. It was the one on YouTube that is available for rental. And I think it's a perfect length. I don't know what was left in the can. I gotta say, I think it was a nice tight film.
An extra 25% left in the can because it is 25 minutes longer. It is wildly long for a comedy.
Yeah, that's a bit long.
Not to show my hand too much, but too long. Like, the theatrical cut is the better version.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, reflecting, I don't know what else I would have wanted to see in this film.
Well, I can think of a few things that I probably would have liked to see in the film, but, like, I don't think that 25 minutes to have an important conversation about, you know, I'm 13, please don't do anything.
Now, Walt, have you seen this movie before?
I've seen this movie before. I've seen it, like, it's one of those situations where you see a movie, like, 70% of a movie, because it's on TBS, where it's, like, a holiday weekend and things are on. So I had seen, like, the whole movie on, like, 5 different occasions, but only 70% of the time. So I had a gist for the plot, but this was nice to kind of sit down, kick back, relax, and watch Big.
I can't believe I saw this in theaters. I'm the only one here.
I think I saw part of this in a class at one point. I don't know what class that would have been other than a, hey, I don't feel like teaching today. Watch Big. There's no lesson to be learned here. I feel like the most pressing or the most relevant content in this, I feel like this is also the kind of movie that everybody has seen, even if they haven't seen it. Like, they know the premise of it. They know the keyboard scene. They know, like, Elizabeth Perkins has sex with a 13-year-old boy. They sort of, I think, get most of the gist of this.
I did not know 2 of 4 of those things.
Really?
Before today. Yeah. So I'm the world's worst film person because I don't watch movies. There's a stunning amount of movies that in pop culture you deem like you have to have seen this or have the reference. I only knew of the piano scene. I didn't really know any of the other context.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel like there's some things that percolate. Like, I feel like the Zoltar machine, I feel like that's a thing that comes up in other stuff. I think, like, yeah, the piano scene, obviously. Yeah, I think it's permeated.
There's sort of similar movies like this throughout the 80s, too. Like, it's not a total body swap type of movie where he's, like, switching roles with his dad and his dad becomes him or anything. But, you know, he does become an adult, and it is sort of halfway there. So there's a little bit of, like, familiarity with the premise if you're sort of coming at it for the first time.
Yeah. Because I think from Comedy Bang Bang, and specifically Lauren Lapkus, I think there is the reverse Big situation that we all know about. And, you know, Zephantine Again is a reverse Big situation. The Young Again Keanu movie is a reverse Big situation.
The movie Little that came out a few months ago?
Little, yeah. There's a lot of reverse big situations. There's also a lot of big situations. Like, but here's a question. Is this one of the first, or is this the first time that this like was a mainstream premise in a movie?
I think there were a lot of, like I mentioned, there were a lot of the ones where like the parent, like Freaky Friday was like a template. And then I think this came along and then we started getting like 13 going on 30, right? Like that is sort of like a version of this, except she doesn't wake up the next day 30. I mean, well, it's not the same year. She wakes up 30 years later or something like that, or 20 years later. But I think this, yeah, took it in that new direction.
Let's kick things off. Now, Walt, you had seen parts of this, most of this, a lot of this on TBS. Now you have watched the whole thing.
Yes.
What would you say is your favorite part? And I feel like this is a difficult thing because I feel like a lot of this movie is kind of like an extended montage of kid as adult.
Yeah.
But if you had to pick a favorite part or a favorite moment or a scene or whatever, what is your favorite part of Big?
I think my favorite part is probably some of the office gags that they get into. Like how John Lovitz asked him to, like, work slower. Come on, don't be new. And then, like, all the very, like, early 90s, late 80s workplace kind of shenanigans. Like, oh, well, he would wear a weird thing to an office party, but he's not seen as a child. He's seen as, like, a weird, crazy guy. And, like, I just thought that some of the, like, the comedy of errors that they got into that was kind of like a pastiche of office life. Of just, like, yeah, you do have the weird guy in the office who goes a little bit too extra at the parties. Yeah. You do have the weird dynamics when it comes to the... And so I thought how, like, effortlessly he blends into a complicated corporate environment was a deeply funny satire of the complicated corporate environment.
Yeah, I love how it's like he doesn't see anything wrong with the way he's acting or dressing or anything.
Yes.
It's like...
Mm-hmm.
But it's a perfect joke that the old guy who runs the company is like, no, 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 let's hear this kid out. Like, he's got some good ideas. He may be a bit weird, but you can't get around. The idea of bugs, transformers, like, give this man more salary. Like, it's just too good.
Yeah, Robert Loggia is smitten by Tom Hanks in this
movie.
Like, so here's my big takeaway. Is that everyone in this company, everyone at Macmillan Toys is horny. Everyone is horny.
It was the 80s. What else are you supposed to do?
They're making the wrong kind of toys.
I guess so. I guess everybody's high on cocaine and horny. But Elizabeth Perkins is like calling people and talking about sex. Obviously, John Lovitz is talking about, like, oh, if you want to go screw that woman, you can. Like, you can just say the word and she'll have her legs wrapped around you. John Hurt is horny. Like, Tom Hanks is horny when, like, he sees down Elizabeth Perkins' blouse. Like, this company, this factory, this, you know, environment that makes children's toys, everyone just wants to fuck. It's just wild for a PG movie.
Yeah, no, it's a bit heavy. I mean, then again, PG meant many different things at the time, right? Like, PG-13 was still rather new, or was it even around yet? Like, I don't know.
I think it was probably around...
Yeah, it was fairly new. About 84, 83, Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, I believe, was like...
So it was like the Wild West. It was like, I don't know what mm-hmm. to rate these movies, but
yeah,
so, I don't know.
Some of them, it's interesting if you go back, like some of them are raunchier, some of them are dirtier, some of them, you know, are straight and clean, but all of them, for some reason, are like PG-13. Because you're right, like it was the Wild West. They were still sort of like feeling out what was acceptable for that rating and stuff. But I was a little sort of taken aback, Joey, especially like last week with all like the sex infused in Dragnet and stuff. Like that's a movie that took it like really far, and
sure,
and this one is still like trying to deal with adult themes, and you know, he's gonna get laid later and stuff. So like I think Penny Marshall, right, she's directing this one, Penny.
Yep.
Like I think Penny Marshall is just trying to sort of pepper this stuff in to say, oh, adult life, casual sex, the 80s, that kind of thing. Like, it's just no big deal. Like, it's just part of the corporate world, the adult world, and he's navigating that, so he's being exposed to it.
You guys are, like, this is the late 80s, right? And so you guys are in the premium Horny Hanks period, where Kennedy Award-winning actor Tom Hanks, for a brief period of time between 1984 and 1992, was permitted to be horny on film. This was then forbidden from him expressly in his contract rider until a brief incident in 1998. But after this, like, I mean, like, there's not a lot of, like, Tom Hanks lecherous man. Like, he kind of makes the quick transition in the mid-90s to a very different way of life. So treasure this while you can. I understand it may be jarring, but, like... This is the premium time, folks.
I think what we're noticing is that we're finding that he's not exactly sure who he is as an actor, and I feel like he's trying a lot of things and kind of, on one hand, being pigeonholed into comedy, but on the other hand, trying to figure out what kind of comedy he wants to do. But he's not quite America's Dad yet. Like, as you know, you know, we ask every episode, like, does he do something in this that he becomes, he's on the road to becoming America's Dad? And, like, a lot of these, it's like, I guess maybe, but, like, he's still not firmly there. And it is an interesting time to watch these Tom Hanks movies.
Well, and I have to admit, the first time he shows up on screen in this film, I thought, oh, young Tom Hanks is really handsome.
Right?
And then I remembered that he's playing a 13-year-old and I got grossed out by myself.
Right.
But then the second thing, as he's playing this child, I was like, he really captures a child so well in just his terms of, like, being interested in something and then not and having no shame. And that, like, even the scene where he just, like, licks all the stuff out of the celery and then puts it back down. Like, he just captures the nuances, and it was really just charming to watch. So, two, in seeing this, I was like, oh, Tom Hanks was, like, a really good actor. He still is a good actor. Like, it was just, it was so refreshing because I haven't watched a Tom Hanks film in forever, and I was like, oh, he is good. This is why he was good. He was even good back then.
What's really nice about this one is that this seems to be or feels like the first time where it's a Tom Hanks movie. Like, a lot of the times in the past, like, he's had co-stars, you know, and shared the screen and all that kind of thing. But I feel like for real now, like, for the first time, it's like he's the leading man here. This is all revolving around him. It's all on his shoulders. And he's doing it, like, I don't want to say effortlessly because, you know, it takes a lot of effort to make it seem like it's effortless. But it just feels so natural. Like, it just feels like he's connected to this character so well.
So I was reading about, like, what they did, and apparently Penny Marshall shot every scene with young Tom Hanks, young Josh, in his role, and he watched what the kid did and then sort of did his spin on that. That's what IMDb says, whether or not that's true, but it was upvoted enough that I think it's probably true. And he also met with the kid who played himself, like, young himself, and talked to him about a lot of different stuff to sort of get in his mind, as it were, and see how he should play a lot of these scenes. So, like, it seems like it works as well as it does because both Penny Marshall and Tom Hanks and the kid all did as much as they possibly could to make sure that the adult version of Tom Hanks acted like a kid.
That is endearing, if true.
Yes.
Right?
Though it does take a little bit away from the performance, you know? Because it's kind of like, Yoda is such a great actor. Wait, you're telling me that there's a puppeteer under... No! Like, at a certain point, like, if he's just imitating the kid, that does take away a little bit from the legendary performance of again, the iconic hero Tom Hanks.
The one problem I kind of had with this movie was, like, we really don't get enough of young Josh.
Oh, we do in the extended cut.
Oh, in the extended cut, I feel it's the only benefit of the extended cut is before he gets big, because we get a bit more of Josh, a bit more of, like, what's bothering him, what he really wants, all this kind of stuff, and it's just, you know, a little deeper. So in that regard, I kind of like knowing that he's portraying the kid as if the kid was doing the role too, because it makes it feel, like, more connected for me.
So Holly, what about you? What was your favorite part of Big?
My favorite part is absolutely the trampoline scene.
Mm,
yeah.
Okay.
Because just he invites her in, and she thinks they're going to bone down, and he's like, no, I'm going to show you all my toys. And he invites her to the trampoline, and just like that coaxing, because he doesn't just get her on it, he wants her to jump and actually enjoy herself. So she gives this like weak little bounce, and he's like, no, come on, you got to do it like this. And like, I was just at an amusement park the other day, and I was in line, and I had commented to the person I was with, I was like, oh, this next ride we're going to go on, is it scary? And the two kids in front of me in line turn around and instantly engage in a conversation, and they're just like lit up, and they're like, oh, you know, you got to do this, and when you go on it, you're going to have butterflies, but if you like, you know, clench your hands real hard, you won't have butterflies. And then when it, like, just like the genuine like enthusiasm of a kid to be like, I want to share my favorite thing, or I'm going to explain and just keep making you do it until you get it right. Like, it was just so cute. And then they're bouncing, and then there's a shot of them outside the windows. She has the dress, and it's like floating up, and like, so you can see her butt, but it's not sexual, it's just like innocent. And it's just a really sweet scene of just like adults being, or well, adult being a kid, and then a kid being an adult being a kid.
And it feels like that trampoline scene, and you know, you mentioning the amusement park, is kind of, I feel like the relationship he wants to have with that blonde side pony, like he just wants to have that trampoline bouncing, just pure fun. Kind of feels like he's, we don't really see him as a kid too much, but it sort of feels like he's too naive that even if he got that girl who's now dating the boy who drives, like if they were in a relationship, I feel like he wouldn't know what to do. And I feel like the trampoline scene is just such a beautiful representation of who he is and really kind of all he wants in this world.
Yeah, and I love that moment because he's not even, sex isn't even on his mind, you know what I mean? Like when she says sleep over. Like, it's played so great, especially like the first couple times you see it, because of how innocent he is, or, you know, just the state of mind that he is. He thinks they're just going to have a sleepover, you know, but to her, spend the night means something totally different. And then he brings out, like, you know, she's kind of like, there's a lot more of Susan in the extended cut, and you see like she has a lot more troubles going on, and she is fleshed out maybe too much more, but I like how he sort of starts, you know, showing her how to have fun again, like, you know, have, you could be childlike without being childish and get away with it, you know, there's a certain way to do it.
And you can see her get, like, just the way that she carries herself and the way that she dresses becomes more childlike by the end of the movie, right? Like, she's not in this rigid, not essentially, you know, the equivalent of, like, a button-down and, like, you know, a really tight ponytail and everything like that. Like, she becomes more freewheeling and easygoing and everything like that. I do have to say, though, when they actually do finally have sex, that's got to be, like, the most unsatisfying sex of all time, right?
It was definitely unsettling, because I don't want to know that 13-year-olds fuck. So I'm glad it was very brief, and you just see him, like, walking around, like, proud the next day, but I was like, oh, geez, this, all right, I guess they had to address it.
I had always remembered this movie as him being at least 15, so, and I had not seen this movie for a few years, and, you know, so many movies since, and so when 13 came up again, I was like, oh.
And I think they make a pretty okay joke about that at the end, where she's like, where she finally realizes that he was a kid, and she says, well, you were like 15 or 16, right? And he says, no, I was 13. She's like, oh, that makes sense. Like, oh, I understand, like, a lot more about what was going on these last few weeks. But Mike, what about you? What was your favorite part? Was your favorite thing something that was not in the original cut, that was in the extended cut, or is your favorite something that you've known, you've seen for years and years and years?
So, it's funny you should say that. I didn't think you'd ask in that way, but there's one scene in the extended cut that is really great and came close to being, like, a new favorite moment, and they go, it's when they go, like, tuxedo shopping. They actually go to, like, a shop and, like, like, really bother the guy working there. He's getting Ajna and everything, and they're trying on and looking at, like, all these different crazy outfits and everything, and he finally settles on the one that he wears. That was, like, I really did enjoy that deleted scene and non-extended scene, but I have to definitely, I just gotta go with F.A.O. Schwartz. I mean, ever since the first time I saw this, like, I was to F.A.O. Schwartz as a little kid. I was, like, you know, huge into toys at this age. I guess I was, like, 9 when I saw this, right? So, you know, I was still playing with toys and stuff, action figures. So, like, him running around F.A.O. Schwartz, like, acting like a kid, playing with that other guy and stuff, and then running into his boss, and then that amazing scene on the piano, which is just movie history now. It's just so well done. And this time I got to give it up for Robert Loggia, man. That guy is jumping around, doing it, like, totally keeping up with Hanks in that sequence. So I still think that holds up incredibly well and should be, you know, on, like, tons of best of clips till the end of time.
I mean, it's, to use Brian's word, an iconic scene, to the point where, like, they parody it essentially in, or not even parody, they just pay homage to it in The Night Before, right? The new Night Before, not the original Keanu Reeves Aunt Becky before she was a criminal movie.
No, and they also pay a very quick homage to it in Shazam, which is sort of a riff on this whole premise where a little boy becomes a big adult but he's got superpowers. So he, like, fights through a mall at one point and steps on the piano and does a little chopsticks or something.
You know, I think my favorite moment in this movie, and I think it was the moment where, like, I knew that Tom Hanks was good in this movie, and I realized later that he had been nominated for an Academy Award, but the first night he spends in St. James Hotel, it's religious, it's fine, where he's trembling on the bed, like, just absolutely terrified that either he's going to get killed or mugged or what. I don't know what is going through his 13-year-old boy in a grown man's head, but he is pulling that off in a great way. And it is, like, amazing to see just the way that he captures the fear of a boy. Like, I mean, not that any of us would really be, like, much braver in that situation, but the way that he captures a 13-year-old on his own, alone, in a place where he could get killed is really, really well done.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably, like, one of the first nights he's ever spent away from home. That is, like, the first night. I think this kind of gets into a little bit of my favorite character in the entire movie, which is his dirtbag friend Billy, who knows what's up, and for whatever reason handles the fact that his buddy is now, like, an old man. Like, he just, like, has a plan for the situation. He's just like, yeah, I know this hotel in downtown. Do you want to go check it out? Like, he just knows exactly what's up, like, as if he's planned for the exact scenario, and how he, like, steals a bunch of money, and, like...
I almost wondered once or twice this time around, because nowadays, especially while doing this podcast and trying to like keep screenings fresh, can a character actually just be a figment of another character's imagination? Fight Club, and Billy comes so damn close, so freaking close. If he doesn't have like that one conversation with Josh's mom, if he doesn't show up like and get made fun of at school, and then at the end when he doesn't run into the girlfriend, I feel like it almost works. But I love Billy because I love like the contrast. Like, he is an adult. He's already like fine, taking care of everything and all that.
He's like the one in the friend group who found cigarettes first. Like, that's just, it's a great character that everybody knows in some way, shape, or form.
What I actually really appreciated about this movie is that Hanks goes to his mom very quickly and is just like, hey, it's me, and she freaks out. But I was like, I wonder how that's going to be handled, and I appreciated it didn't wait for a while. It's like, well, let's just see if this works, and it doesn't, and then that's when he goes to Billy, and Billy's like, oh yeah, like, you know the song? My best friend knows the song. You gotta be my best friend. And then from there on, it's just like smooth sailing for the two of them. But I liked that the movie didn't really wait to see the Hanks mom interaction. But what I was confused about is how, like, the whole kidnapping plot or whatever just sort of gets dropped.
Yeah, that would absolutely gain national attention, because not only does he go missing, a man barges into her house giving all these answers and then runs out and isn't seen again. Like, I feel you would absolutely, it wouldn't just be dropped. Like, he would be on, like, America's Most Wanted.
Yeah,
sure. I mean, he would also be all over Nancy Grace, I can tell you that much.
Yes. Yeah, so those kind of shows.
If it were me today, by the time that he ends up returning to his family, there will be an original Netflix true crime miniseries about the disappearance.
Yeah, there's like one joke in this where they're like, who is Josh Baskin? Where does he come from? And they're drinking milk and his face is on the milk carton, right? And that is like so old school. Like, I don't know if they still do that, but that's the only time they do it, is like, to, as a joke, he calls his mom. That is a very strange scene, even today, where it's like, you know, he's pretending to be his own kidnapper instead of like still trying to convince her of the truth, and Billy's not talking to her. It feels a little mishandled, but then again, when you're like, well, they should flesh this out more, you don't want to see what they do with it in the extended cut. Like, there's really no way to make that work much better, so I feel like they do their best by just sort of moving on and trying to like not get too involved with it as much as possible.
And I think that's my least favorite part of the movie, is just because I think it naturally becomes part of the story, but they don't know how to continue it. And I feel like for an Academy Award nominated screenplay, it feels like kind of a glaring hole. I just don't know. Like, I don't know how you weave that in.
But, like, what do you want? Do you want him, like, running around town like Jean Valjean? Like no. Like, he's just, like, at a certain point, you need a reason for him to stay away from home and had to stay in the crappy flop house and get a job. Like, other than that, yeah.
I just think we need, like, one scene where the mom's like, all right, I'm okay with my kid being missing. Or, like, I don't know. I don't know what I want, but I want something.
Well, even he writes to her, so it's not like he disappears and, like, she's like, he's dead. Like, he's, I guess, taunting her in a way by, in his mind, letting her know he's okay. But like, I want to see her like 20 pounds slender, like dark circles, chain smoking like everybody else in this film, just horrified that her son has been kidnapped by a random man.
Yeah, like, he's gonna have so much explaining to do when he gets home. Like, he never even thought of working on this lie, or who took him, or why, or what he's been up to. Like, you know, I mean, we're not supposed to be thinking about this kind of stuff, but it's fun to try and to see, like, what is it trying to accomplish with that?
That, again, this is a movie that, like, outwardly has one obviously messed up thing about it, but then, like, when you keep on peeling away the onion, you keep on getting more weird. Like, the only reason that he needs to wait, like, 3 months to find out how he can get back home is because apparently the only solution that they thought of to find this machine was to call the government.
Bureaucracy at its finest.
Yeah, they go to, like, the Hall of Records.
They just go to the government! They just say, hey, where's this machine? And they're just like, yes, we've got a man on that. It'll take a month.
They've got top men on the job. Holly, what about you? Do you have a least favorite part about Big? What about this didn't work for you?
That's a good question.
I mean, it can be the fact that a 35-year-old woman has sex with a 13-year-old boy. Like, that's a perfectly acceptable answer.
No, I mean, the only, like, I can't really think of anything, because a lot of just where it felt awkward were actual moments where, like, you know, when he first hops on the piano and his boss is like, okay, like, give it up. But he keeps going. And then in him keeping going, we all, like, celebrate the joy of, like, you know, innocence and youth. And that turns itself around. And even in the scene where he's eating all the vegetables and putting them back down, or he, like, eats the weird baby corn just for way too long with his teeth. Like, kids do weird, dumb shit. So just, like, there wasn't anything I liked. There were just moments where I was like, this is awkward. But then I'm like, oh, this is an authentic portrayal of, like, a 13-year-old boy who has zero self-awareness. I don't know if there was anything that I actually really disliked other than, yeah, when you peel away those layers and you think about, okay, well, when he returns home and the year, countless years of therapy he's going to be in to try to get, like, information as to why he's missing and why he's not talking and why he's making up this weird I was an adult story, and then, you know, even what comes of his sexuality for sleeping with an older woman at 13.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's, like, that's beyond it.
You said earlier that you're bad at movies. Is this a movie, do you think, would you watch this movie again?
I think I would. Yeah, like, this was some, if this was on TV, I would stop flipping through channels. I would leave this on.
Because I do think that there's a real benefit to the theatrical cut where it does sort of fly by.
Right.
Like, you know, Mike and I have been sort of alluding at it, but there's so much just build up and then sort of, like, I feel like kind of the middle of the bell curve is sort of the same, right? Like the, a lot of the middle is kind of very similar, but it's just the beginning and the end are just like, oh boy, this is taking a while to get going. So much so that, like, after I watched the extended and I put the theatrical on, it's like the movie can't wait to get to Tom Hanks. It's like, oh, 6 minutes? Cool, time to go big. The extended is like probably, what, 15 minutes? Like, there's so much early on and stuff at the end. But I feel like the breeziness of the short, like, hour 40 theatrical cut is, like, it's exactly the kind of movie, Holly, that, like, if you're flipping through channels, you stop on because there's something that you know and remember and is charming to some extent or another, like, in every scene.
Even in the meeting when, you know, he's like, well, why are we making a building? Why are we making a transformer? Like, he just has all these genuine moments that then lead to other things, like, even in the relationship when he first starts it. But it is just sweet. And even all, like, the further scenes, like, I thought he was going to get accidentally drunk on scotch at the party. He doesn't. He just wears, like, a tuxedo. And as they go along, like, she drinks wine, but he's still just drinking soda and eating pizza. So, like, he never becomes corrupted, which was also, like, really sweet. Like, I thought for sure, like, something really awful was going to happen to him. But no, he just, like, keeps gaining these successes and could actually, I guess, make it as a 35-year-old man, maybe.
On this point, like, I don't think that a longer version of this works, because I checked, and, like, I had a terrifying realization while watching the film. I don't know if you guys noticed this, but did you know that Big literally subscribes to point-by-point Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey?
Does it really?
Yes, it does. There's Supernatural Aid, A Call to Adventure. He crosses the first threshold with the help of a mentor. He eventually makes the second threshold, which is he's promoted. He then refuses the return, and then he's rescued from without. And then again, he decides to sacrifice himself and cross back. There's a climax, and then he returns to where he started again, knowing more of the world and its inhabitants. No joke, Big legitimately subscribes directly to The Hero's Journey by Joseph Campbell.
Well, Walt, what you don't know is that the extended cut adheres to the unedited, the unabridged version of The Hero's Journey, which includes some stopovers here and there and several times at the hotel. It's the first draft of The Hero's Journey.
I'm curious to hear more about this extended version, because it definitely sounds like there's some scenes that you guys either didn't like or thought were too long, and I want to hear what those are.
Yeah, so this is definitely, you know, I'm going to use this as my least favorite part of the movie is, you know, I went and turned this on last night at midnight, and then I text Joey. I was like, 2 hours and 10 minutes? I was like, what the hell is happening?
So hold on, wait. So let's take a step back. So Walt, I'm sure you know this, and Holly, you might know this too, but yesterday, Mike and fellow host on the podcast network, Brian Rodriguez, came over, and Brian, being a New York City resident, brought some nutcrackers for us to celebrate the summer season.
Sure.
And so Mike had a nutcracker. We all had nutcrackers, but Mike was like, oh no. And I was like, Mike, how fucked up did the nutcrackers get you that you think this movie is wildly longer than it is? Because I looked it up on IMDb, I looked it up on Letterboxd, I was like, 104 minutes, easy breezy, in and out. And then Mike's like, it's 2.5 hours. I was like, what? I was like, hold, Mike, how much nutcracker did you drink?
Okay, nutcracker meaning like the Coney Island?
Yes.
Drink?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because for, like, the first 40 seconds, I was like, why a nutcracker? Like, the Christmas things? What? Is this, like, a new drug? Like, what? And then I remember...
It basically is a new drug, yeah.
Kind of, right? Yeah, I mean, it was heavy for me, who was not a heavy drinker, but it kicked my ass yesterday. And, like, I ended up coming home and, like, passing out for a couple hours, waking up, and then being, like, sober and being, I gotta do something. So I was like, I'm gonna watch Big. And that's what was so shocking, was to find out that that's when I knew there is an extended cut. So I rolled the dice and I was like, I'll watch this one. At least I'll watch it first. And my biggest takeaway from it is it's not a comedy anymore. It's like a heavy drama now.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, it feels devoid of joy for most of it, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe I'm just so used to the theatrical cut and so familiar with it, but it uses, like, alternate takes, extended sequences, just little bits here and there that really just kind of feel more redundant than anything else. It really doesn't seem to help flesh anything out that I needed to know. You know, it more or less just seemed like, well, we shot everything that was in the script, and now we're just going to whittle it down to the best bits. And this cut just seemed like maybe someone was like, maybe they just reinserted deleted scenes or something. But as far as I'm concerned, it did not work. It was tough to watch.
And I feel like there's not really, I mean, I'm also not as familiar with, I mean, like I said before, I don't know if I've ever seen the original cut from start to finish before, ever, actually, because I saw the first, like, half of it before we started recording. But I don't think there's any scene in here that, like, doesn't really work on its own. I feel like it's the accumulation, the culmination of all of it added together that really kind of just makes it feel long and sort of heavy and more dramatic. Like, you're right. Like, it's, there's just so much, like, hey, you know that comedy you like? You want to know the backstory? Well, not really. I mean, like, maybe, but, like, I don't need to.
Yeah, and we're away from Josh for way too long as well. Like, we spent a lot of time with Susan. We spent more time with Loja. Like, there's more, like, office characters sort of fleshed out a little more there, and that's not good. Like, we can't be away from Hanks for too long, you know, or else start wondering where he's at and, like, right. Get disconnected.
Like, the more flesh there is on John Lovitz, the worse the movie is.
And I was surprised, like, you know, I was like, okay, let me get a Robert Loja backstory here, but we don't really. Like, he talks about creating some kind of duck toy, and instead I was hoping to get maybe, you know, he had, like, some kid or a son or something that he hadn't talked to in years, and that's why Josh was, like, maybe a son to him, or he was treating him in a certain way, giving him favoritism or something, but none of that.
What about you? Did you say your least favorite moment, Walt?
My least favorite moment. I was pretty up on it. Like, I enjoyed the movie a lot. I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought that, like, again, like, it's one of those fun movies where, like, it's a good movie. You enjoy watching it. If you think about it for more than 30 seconds, it gets really interesting to kind of tear apart. But I really did. I think it was wholesome and fun, and I liked it a lot. I liked his apartment a lot. I'm trying to think of something that I didn't like about it. I don't know. I think that, in general, I think that it's a pretty well-constructed movie, and I don't really have too many problems with it beyond, like, the obvious. I guess it's one of those situations where, like, his creative peak, his greatest success, is coming up with this idea for a vaguely interactive comic book. So he basically came up with the idea of a Kindle that does choose-your-own-text adventures. And then you have to, and then it's, like, freemium content on top of it where you need to buy new stories for it. And, like, knowing where freemium content goes, he's the greatest villain in the history of toys. I have to say, he is the grandfather of the loot box and the pay-to-play, and the you have to DLC the bonus stuff. Like, Tom Hanks in Big is, frankly, as the inventor of DLC, frankly, the J. Robert Oppenheimer of his time.
Well, she calls him a genius in that scene several times. She's like, that's all she could say. You're a genius. You're a genius. You're a genius. I'm like, evil genius.
Yeah, he's propelled to read from the Bhagavad Gita, I am death, destroyer of worlds. Like, you won't be able to enjoy video games anymore. You need to buy an extra DLC to get it. So yeah, I don't know beyond that. But I got on that because I think that, like, it's one of the situations where if you come up with, like, a product or a joke in a movie that's like, oh, this is the funniest joke, or the best, or song. Song's a great example. Like, the song in Rent, which is like, oh, this is my one greatest song. This is the greatest thing I'll ever do. And it's like kind of the worst song in Rent. It's like this, where, like, he's such a genius. He came up with the best toy. And, like, clearly, like, they're not toy designers. So they didn't come up with, like, the Lego. So I always thought it was funny. It was just like, yes, this is it. This is the brass ring. And it's kind of a bad idea for a toy.
I also can't believe that they're selling that, like, essentially, you know, choose your own adventure tablet of sorts for $18. That feels wildly inexpensive.
Oh, it was 1988. That kind of feels about right. That's probably, like, around, like, the $50-$60 range, maybe.
No way. Hold on. 1988, $20.
Well, I'm telling you, that's what it felt like as a 9-year-old kid. If you had $20 in your pocket, like,
$43.
It's about two times as much. Yeah, it's about double inflation.
But I think that's a great bargain, you know? If you only need to buy the main unit once, right? It's like a Game Boy, and then you just keep buying little additional storylines and stuff and switching them out.
It's the same reason that printers are so cheap at Printers Inc. That's where they get you. The initial storybook, cheap as heck, but all the DLC items, that's where it starts adding up, you know?
Ugh. Hanks is truly a monster.
He's the worst.
You know, when he left, like, they totally went with this idea anyway. They're like, this is too good to be true. Like, I don't care if he comes back. I don't care if he was 12. Like, we're going with it.
Again, peeling back the onion, you have a star employee who has, like, really charmed the company. He walks out of a meeting excusing himself and never comes back.
Never to be seen again. And it makes me wonder, too, when he has to corroborate his story, is he going to go and try and find Susan? Like, are the cops knocking on her door? But, like, in a week or so?
No, because if this is an office environment, what do? They file a police report. Like, hey, Josh hasn't shown up to work for 3 days. And then how do they explain that a 13-year-old boy that's been missing for months, like, see? This is the great part. Like, this is where we're getting into the real breakdown of it, because the idea is that they would be implicated in the kidnapping of this kid.
I like that there are two Josh Baskin missing persons cases. Yeah. I want to see the cop story where there's like a Pepe Silvia style where the guy's like, I got Josh Baskin missing over here, yeah, and I got Josh Baskin missing over here, and I think they're connected, but I don't know how. And then there's like all sorts of string and everything, and then there's the madness where he says, these are the same person, and no one believes him. And then it's this guy down on his luck and losing his mind and trying to prove to the world that these are the same boy, the same man, and he cannot do it, and then he goes insane. And then he meets Josh Baskin. He's like, oh yeah, that was me the whole time. And then that's like his denouement.
Yeah. He was a cop with everything on the line. Just 2 days left till retirement until the Zoltar machine came in.
God damn you, Zoltar.
Big two. Book it.
Whew, boy. Two Hank connections, Mike. Number one, when he is playing early in the movie, whatever that ice game is, I was like, is this Mazes and Monsters, the video game?
Ooh, a holy man. Check it out.
Right?
I love
and then
that.
Also, we were talking before that when he goes in the extended cut to that tuxedo shop, it reminded me in reverse of the very first Tom Hanks movie, yep, He Knows You're Alone, the wedding dress shop run by the guy just chomping, smoking cigars the entire time, stinking up all the dresses.
I thought the exact same thing. It made me so happy that that's the one scene in all of, you know, aside from when Hanks gets big, I actually kind of quite enjoy, we get a little bit of Billy's home life and see how crazy that is. We get a little more of Josh's home life. But when he becomes Hanks, just no more extra stuff except the tuxedo shop. That was really funny. That was a lot of good energy.
And there's also one sort of future Hanks connection in that both the movie of the summer, Toy Story 4, also takes place in an amusement park. Like, the big action scenes are in an amusement park. Now, I was also realizing Jordan Peele in Toy Story 4, Jordan Peele, us, like, he's got a lot of amusement park things going on this year, too. Like, I don't know, are amusement parks, like, Walt, do you have any numbers to crunch from Numlock News? Like, are amusement parks, are they big business right now?
I think that, like, Toy Story is an amusement park because after Coco, they really revolutionized the way that they can do lights. And amusement parks inherently look good on film because of the exciting lighting going on in the background. And I think that they were kind of trying to show off a little bit with Toy Story 4 because after they did the Coco, like, the Coco tech is that you could have, like, 7 million lights on one screen and then how to square that circle, right? And that is what a carnival is, right? Like, having all the lights interact in different ways. So I think that was just kind of them flexing. As for Jordan Peele and us, I don't know. I think that he said somewhere in an interview about why he did it by the boardwalk at, like, where places, like, at the shore where places meet. It was a fun idea, but I love it. I think it's a great mood for summer. I think that summer boardwalks are always fun.
Yeah, and it's carnival season, you know? Like, there's been so many carnivals, like, in my area over the last few weeks and all that kind of stuff. But Joey, there's also another connection. There's sort of like a twofer.
Oh, yeah?
They play a lot of, like, stickball in this movie, you know, a lot of baseball stuff. And, you know, Hanks is going to be playing, or at least he's going to be coaching a lot of baseball soon. Mm. And not only that, but also with Penny Marshall at the helm.
Very cool. We also mentioned it earlier, but we never called specific attention. I think this is the second time, maybe, that we have young Tom Hanks after Splash.
Oh, right, right.
Or do we have it again? Do we have young Hanks in Dragnet? No.
No. I like, this kid looks a lot like Hanks. Like, I think they did a good job.
I think he was wearing contacts to change his eyes to make him look more like actual Tom Hanks. So here's a rundown of the actors who were considered for this. So this is basically like the everyone in Hollywood type of thing, where apparently no one cared about this script until Robert De Niro took an interest.
What?
He wanted $6 million, and they were like, we can't do that. But they were like, we can't pay him $6 million. But because he was interested in it, everyone else sort of got interested. So here's a list of people.
Before you go down the list, can I just name while watching it this time? Because I never considered anyone else in this role, but watching it this time, one name came to mind and I think would have killed it. Eddie Murphy. I just think Eddie Murphy would have been pretty amazing as this character.
So these are all white guys, so there is no creativity there. Deborah Winger turned down the part, or she was offered the Susan role. She turned down the role, but she had asked Penny Marshall, would you ever consider doing a gender swap and have a little girl become big? And she said, and Penny Marshall said, no, because I can't imagine a world that it's okay where a 35-year-old man is essentially having sex with a 13-year-old girl in an adult woman's body.
Compelling point, Penny.
Shout out Penny Marshall for having sensibility there. But okay, here are the names of people who were considered or wanted or turned it down or couldn't do it or conflicts or whatever. John Travolta, who apparently was like one of the first choices, but he was box office poison. So this was before Look Who's Talking. So before Amy Heckerling revived him, right?
Yeah, forget about Tarantino. Amy Heckerling revived him.
Harrison Ford, which would have been crazy. Dennis Quaid, Steve Guttenberg, Albert Brooks, Judge Reinhold, Michael Keaton.
Hold on. You're going a little too fast.
I know, but I just got to... There's so many, Mike. Bill Murray, Robin Williams, John Goodman, and Jeff Bridges.
Wow. Pretty cool. I mean, it's not like Jeff Bridges was Jeff Bridges today. I mean, he had been doing stuff and been doing great work and stuff, but that would have been really weird to see that Jeff. Like, Dennis Quaid makes sense, too. He seems really safe. I mean, he was really good at Interspace around this time and everything. Martin Short, is he on the list? He would have been great, too, but I don't know.
No, he wasn't.
Okay.
Apparently Tom Hanks was also cast at one point and then thought he couldn't do it because of conflicts with Dragnet and Punchline. Mm-hmm. So one that we did already, and I think the next movie we're doing, De Niro dropped out or something like that, and he was able to do it. And so they had cast the kid, what's his name, David Moscow, who is the young Josh, young Tom Hanks. But they had, I guess, fired him because he didn't look like De Niro. But then when Hanks took back over, they rehired him. So what a roller coaster.
Oh, that's funny.
And the only other trivia that I have, I think, is that the Shimmy Shimmy Cocoa Pop rap and the... him eating the baby corn were both Tom Hanks' ideas, that he wrote the lyrics to that rap and he improvised the corn eating. And I think this might be our first, what's his name, Chet? Is Chet Hanks the rapping son of Tom Hanks?
Oh, that's right.
Oh God, no.
Apparently, I don't know if this is Colin or this is Chet, but he said that he heard when his son went to summer camp, he learned a song like this. And so Tom Hanks wrote lyrics that were sort of reminiscent of that. So I don't know if that's, you know, a young rapping Chet Hanks soon to be saying the N-word and getting everybody upset at him.
That's what it reminded me of, you know, like a summer camp kind of secret, yeah, handshake kind of thing that just, you know, when you're at camp and you just have like all day to figure it out and like it just goes on and on and on, so.
Yeah. Holly, we got a couple games to play, but before we play the games, is there anything else you want to say about Big? Anything that you, you know, loved or hated or wanted to make note of?
No, I really liked it. So there's a lot of times where people are like, oh, you got to go back and watch this movie from the 80s. And I do. And I'm like, why did we all get hyped up about this? This was something that I watched and I authentically enjoyed. And I was like, oh, wow, this movie's like 30 years old and it's still charming. That being said, I absolutely don't think it's a movie that could be made in this day and age, which was interesting to think of. Two things. A, I don't think it could be made in 2019 and have anybody feel comfortable. B, this is absolutely a movie where you couldn't do a gender swap version of it because it would just be horrifically creepy. So really, it's locked into casting those genders, those roles, having been made in the time that it was. So at least we can say that we never have to, you know, expect a remake of this, because I just don't think it would ever go over or be greenlit.
Yeah?
I don't know. I think that they would do it. I think that they would just cut it. Like, I think that they would just recut the script a little bit to remove any component of sexuality in it. And I think that it, like, could legitimately work.
You know, I wonder if, because of that fear, like, whether they have tried it and doesn't work, or whether they just don't want to touch it or whatever, like, I wonder if that's why we're getting the reverse. Like, if that's why we're getting little instead of big. Like, I wonder if they're, like, it's easier to take an adult, although they're also, like, there's weird sexualization there, like, in the trailer, at least, I haven't seen Little, but when she gets Little and she's, like, hitting on her teacher, it's like, well, that's kind of creepy, too.
Isn't Little a Freaky Friday situation, where it's, like, a relationship between the two people?
No, it's just the older woman gets turned into a little girl. Yeah, it's literally, like, reverse big.
A classic reverse big situation.
But, like, if I recall right, like, in movies, you know, like, father like son and those kinds of things, when the dad and the son did switch parts, like, it was very hard to ignore, like, sexual content. Like, there was always a scene where, like, the dad's girlfriend tried to have sex with him and didn't know it was the son, so like, it's hard to know, like, if they'd even want to try it without that you know, if they're just like, well, we can't have them doing it, so like, why even bother? But like, it would be nice if they tried.
Either way, again, that is one of four or five things where if you think about big too hard, you should stop thinking. Not the least of which is that this is not the last time that Tom Hanks is involved in the toy industry. What if Tom Hanks is his own god? What if Tom Hanks what if Woody was created by the McCallum Toy Company, and therefore Tom's in an act of divine autogenesis managed to manifest himself in I don't want to think. See, don't scratch it stuff. That's a mistake.
I feel like this is the kind of thing where, like, you see the, like, you watch a Toy Story movie, then, like, 3 years later, they announce a new Pixar movie, and it's like, well, if you remember, back, like, they panned across the floor, and you saw the toy there. Like, it was there in front of our eyes the whole time. Yeah. It's like you watch Big very slowly, and there's just, like, a cowboy hat and a yellow ball with a red star on it, and there's, like, a slinky dog. It's like, oh, no, it's all coming true. Walt, any other thoughts about this before we play the games that you know that we play?
No. I thought, again, like, I think that the real star of the movie for me is Billy, the vaguely mature friend who manages to guide a grown-ass man through being a grown-ass man just by virtue of being willing to steal and go to seedy hotels and stuff. I think that he is a perfect character, and if they ever made a spinoff of him, I think that that would be the way to go.
And I don't think that that kid really did anything else much past this. Like,
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. I think he's in that.
Yeah, and he's in Overboard with Goldie and Kurt Russell, but like, he's only in like a handful of movies. Like, this Jared Rushton kid should have been in everything. Could have been a star. Mike, what about you? Any other thoughts about Big?
Just want to say, watch the theatrical cut. yeah. Totally forget about this extended thing. Like, maybe if you want to see the scenes, go on YouTube if you have an extra 20 minutes and just watch them as deleted scenes, because integrated back into the film, it really does nothing. It detracted from me, to be quite honest. Like I said earlier, it turned it from like a comedy, a nice quick comedy, into a slow, drawn out drama that I didn't really want to get like too deep into, you know, like we've been talking about. Don't want to think about Big too hard or too long. Just enjoy its fun, easy breeziness and, you know, get in and out of there. And it is remarkable how well it still plays and stuff. And it's also really cool, like Holly was saying, how like it's locked in that own time that it was made. Like, it's sort of like a movie that could only be done then and all that kind of thing. So there's like a certain kind of kismet that was like going on here that you can kind of feel the energy and everything. And so I really like that.
I've got two things we can play the game. Number one, I think that what Holly was saying about how it holds up, like, I think that's something that is not true of a lot of 80s Hanks movies. Like, Holly, what we've learned going through these again, through the early, you know, the mid-80s, like what Walt, I think, was sort of saying earlier, like, this is like a horny Hanks period. Like, a lot of these are problematic and troubling in the way that a lot of classic 80s movies are, that it's not great looking at it with 2019 eyes. This one has some questionable parts, but I think for the most part, holds up. The more important thing, though, Mike, knowing my Fast and Furious allegiance, is that when Hanks is in the limo and he goes to the moonroof, he says, ejector seat. And I was like, ejecto seat, cuz. So a little bit of shout out to Roman Pierce, Barstow. There we go. Now, Holly, I don't know if you've listened to any of our episodes of the Tom Tom Club, but we're alternating Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks movies, as I'm sure you know. And so we wonder every episode if Tom Cruise was cast in the role of Josh, if he was in the Tom Hanks part in this movie, what would that movie be like? Or, if that's so crazy to think about, what other role, what other part in this movie could he play that would work better for Tom Cruise? We'll let you go first if you have an idea. If you want to think about it a little bit, we can spread it around.
No, because my initial thought was, if this was Tom Cruise in this movie, I would have turned it off 5 minutes in.
Oof.
And I would have been the odd man out on this podcast, as I am known to have done.
Mad Holly Gore.
Mad Holly Gore. I know, we're all in agreement for the first time in a little while, I think.
This is a nice change of pace, yeah.
Yeah, I think he could have played jerky business guy Tom Hanks is up against, especially in the scene where they go and they play racquetball, I think it is, outside, and then he takes the ball and he's like, you're cheating, and refuses to give it back. I think he would have been a really good person to play that scene against. But Too, this is a bit of a personal bias. I am not inclined to like Tom Cruise, so I really can only see him excelling in an adversarial role in which I can be okay with it. I don't want to cheer for him. I don't want to be endeared by him. So yeah, that's my two cents.
I'm going to say that if he was in the role, he would have fucked Elizabeth Perkins way faster. Like, I just think that would have been like a slam dunk. I'm just like, hey, let's get it done. But I agree with you all. I think that he would have played the John Hurd role really well. Dad from Home Alone, having a big time in the 1980s and the late 80s there. I think he probably could have done it. I don't know if there would have been like the childlike glee and joy that Tom Hanks brings to it. I think he probably could have. And I think that, Mike, this might be one of the first times where it's like, he might not actually be as good as Hanks. There's a lot of the roles that we've seen so far he could do, but I feel like this one might be, we might be starting to sort of see the kind of role that Tom Hanks is, you know, known for. And I'm not sure, but I think I agree with Holly that he could have played the John Hurd role well, or if he was Josh, he would have had sex with Elizabeth Perkins way sooner.
Tom Cruise emerged fully formed from the womb, age 16, and like dripping with like you know, like he's never had innocence. Like, I think that that's the, like, he's never had a male ingenue kind of vibe, and I think that that's just a thing that is not in his repertoire. He plays worldly very well. He plays like savvy very well, but I don't think that he plays like innocent or childlike or out of his depth kind of well. I think that like his core competency is his competency. Like, I think that he's good at playing competent characters, whereas Hanks has, I think, the wherewithal to kind of give it up a little bit and cede a little bit of power and control to those around him. So I don't know. I think that that's a really, really good question. And I just do not think that Tom Cruise is capable of doing this, because I do not think that Tom Cruise was ever a child.
Yeah. I agree. I can't imagine him as a little kid.
Yeah, spot on.
Mike, what about you? Do you think he could have played this, or would it be the John Hurt role, or would it be something else?
Okay, so bear with me, because I'm going to get a little nuts here. I have a crazy idea. Tom Cruise as Big Billy.
I was just thinking, yeah, like the Bigs, like plural two, they both get big.
Yeah.
They both get, like, Billy finds the Zoltar and gets big and shows up one day and is like, I'm big too. And it's big T-O-O, big two.
No, that would be perfect. Holy crap.
And you got Hanks and Cruz.
Love it.
Just bigging it up in the big city.
Though, I don't know. Big 2 already exists in that case, because what was that movie where he runs drugs in and out of Colombia? That's just what Billy would do if he were big.
American Made.
American Made is Big 2.
American Made is, legally speaking, Big 2. It's what would happen if Billy got big.
I love it. Now, Holly, one other very important question here. Pretend for a second that you, in 2019, you as you are today, got transported back in time. You won a walk-on role in the movie Big. What scene are you putting yourself in? Like a cameo kind of role, maybe a couple lines. You're not, like, replacing anyone in the cast, but you're just here or there saying something, doing something. What scene do you want to be a part of?
I think definitely part of The Office.
Okay.
Just like when he's playing, like one of his coworkers that thinks like, oh, this is the weird guy in The Office, but he's fun. So some kind of fun interactive scene where maybe I shoot him back with the Nerf gun or I duck and roll and I make a comment being like, that new guy's a real breath of fresh air. And like, you know.
I feel like there's a real lack of playfulness, like people, like when he's like on, I mean, I guess it would be annoying and I understand where they're coming from, but as he's like riding the, you know, the scooter down the hall, or like there's like the RC car or whatever, everything you hear is like, hey guy, this is an office, like let's calm down. But like, you make toys, like I understand why it's an office, but I also feel like we need someone like you, Holly, to be like, I like this guy, and just like, you know, playing games with him. But you're the awful, you're, you know, you're the successful businesswoman who is also at the same time, you know, having a little bit of fun at work.
Like, I would absolutely laugh if somebody, like a coworker, ran a remote control car into somebody else's legs in the office, because it's just, it's goofy and it's funny. And especially if you mutually don't like that person because they're a stick in the mud, that's something to laugh at.
Absolutely. Now, Walt, what about you? Where would you put yourself in this movie?
This is a great question. So, like, I do want to, like, hop on that briefly. Like, I worked for Disney when I was at 538, and, like, Disney's just a company. Like, they have accounting departments that I don't think that everybody's trying to have a magical day. Like, I understand the appeal of, like, I just want to punch in and not have a phantasmagorical experience with the toy line that I'm creating. I understand that. And what role would I play if I were a bit part or a cameo? I have two in mind, either municipal employee working hard to find this machine, or carny. I would also be a carny.
Ooh, yeah. Yes.
I think that there's a lot of room there for somebody of my talents, either municipal or employee or carny, or municipal employee moonlighting as a carny.
Because really, I mean, when you come down to it, is there much of a difference?
That's the thing. You get those bennies from 9 to 5, and then you get the real money at night. Like,
wait, I have a question. So this is maybe a question for Holly and Walt, because you're New York residents and I'm not. Is the address of, like, Sea Point Park or whatever, is that enough to get to a place? Because it feels like there's missing information. Like, it feels like if I was being told, that was like a logic puzzle in math, I would be like, there's not enough information here for me to figure out what I'm supposed to do. Like, is that an address? Or is that a place? Or is that not?
So I've lived here for 3 years, and I still don't know if certain neighborhoods are real or if somebody just made it up. So I'm not the best person to ask.
Fair.
So yes, I would need more information.
Walt?
I understand the same thing. I have a friend who's just moving to North-South Cobble Hill, which is actually just Cobble Hill, but like, what are you going to do?
North-South Cobble Hill?
Exactly, yeah, it's just Cobble Hill. But it sounds much more illustrious when there's directions involved, like East Williamsburg or West Elmhurst. I would say that that is good, but oftentimes not enough. Because like, if you told me, oh, I'm going to meet you at Astoria Park, that's not a huge place, and like, you would notice a carnival there, right? But if you said like, oh, I'm going to meet you in Central Park, you're kind of fucked. Or like, if it was like Queens Corona Park, honestly, if you're trying to hunt down a carnival in New York City, it's not like really hard. Like, they're very loud. Like, you can smell the funnel cake. It sticks to you. It's not like hiding, and they're not camouflaged, so I don't know necessarily what the damage was.
Very fair. All right. So I feel like there's not enough information. I think we're all going to collectively say not enough information there.
Yeah.
Mike, what about you? Where are you putting yourself in this movie?
I'm going to really hide myself in this movie, and I'm going to be in the scene when him and Susan go to, I guess, Susan's friend's dinner party, and there's like Susan and him, the friend and her husband, and then another couple. Like, I guess I'll be with another couple. You know, we'll just make room for me and my date at that table there. And the party will just be, like, a slightly bigger. You know, you only see me for a minute because that kid comes in and Hanks gets up to help him and stuff. But, you know, blink and you miss me.
All right, I like that. I'm going to put myself in a new role at the very end of the movie, last scene. Elizabeth Perkins does her emotional farewell to Josh. And he's walking, and, like, you know, he walks from big to little. I'm going to be walking my dog, and I'm going to be, like, a dog I don't have, but a dog I have in the movie. And I'm going to be, like, wait, what's happening? And I'm going to be, like, you know, comically rubbing my eyes. Like, I can't believe what I'm seeing here.
You witness him get small.
Yeah.
Like, no one believes you, and you, like, lose your mind.
You look at your flask, and you shake your head, and you throw it away.
Yeah, and I connect with the detective from my earlier thing, and the two of us get together and try to figure out what the real story of this missing Josh guy is. That's the real mystery. Okay, final important question of the night for everyone, and I don't know the answer to this. Does Tom Hanks do anything in this movie that sets him on the path to becoming America's dad?
Well, he ages.
Maybe that scene where he helps the kid with his algebra homework, right? Because the real dad wouldn't bother to get up from his party to help his own son. Mm-hmm. Like, Hank sees a fellow 13-year-old in distress and goes to help him. I mean, granted, his character's 13. But, you know, still, Josh has something in him, right? That, like, when he grows up, it seems like he's going to be a pretty good dad one day.
That's fair. What do you guys think? Walt, Holly, do you think that he's doing anything here that gets him to becoming America's dad?
I think that he gets his shit together pretty quick for a 13-year-old, you know? Like, he finds a job. He gets a job. He gets a promotion at the job. He gets an apartment. Is that how my apartment would look? No. Is that what a dad's apartment looks like? No. Is that the way that my apartment should look? Yes, I want my apartment to look like that. But, yeah, I think that he does, like he cleans up nice, I guess is what I would say, in a way that is kind of typically unexpected. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of stricken about how, like, responsible Josh becomes and almost forgets at the end that he was a kid at one point when Billy comes to tell him they found the machine. He's like, I got work to do. It's like, what's going on exactly?
Is there a version of this movie where he stays an adult?
I don't know how you end the movie, though. I mean, maybe he finds his old-time machine, puts the coin in, and at the last second he, like, turns it over and, like, smashes it with a bat or something? Like, really, how was it? I don't know how to conclude that, but it would be interesting.
Again, it's a Joseph Campbellian hero's journey. You can't end the hero's journey while still in the abyss. He must refuse the call and then take it once again. Yeah, no, I think that there's a world in which that happens. I think that it's, like, in the extra super-duper long director's cut, in, like, the fucked-up producer cut, that could be what happens.
Very, very fair. So the final thing we're going to do here is we're going to nominate this film for the Woodies, our Tom Hanks Awards. I'm going to say here, best film, yes, because it is better than The Money Pit, and that's the only nominee that we have there. Best Hanks role?
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like his ultimate role right now, right? Because I truly feel like this is a culmination of everything he's been trying out, and then he's like, he found a way to make the best stuff work really well in this project.
Yeah. I mean, if you want something that's, like, again, this, we mentioned this earlier, but you are right now in the prime rib of Tom Hanks. Like, you are a couple years into it, you got a couple years at the end of it, but, like, this is gonna end. He's gonna try it again later. He's gonna try to be a sexy man when it comes to those Angels and Demons books, and you know what? It's not gonna work out. So now you need to treasure it. Now you need to hold it in your arms and enjoy the fact that Tom Hanks is a sexy person and has a sexual life and is a sexual organism. And if you want the poster child for this era, I would suggest it's Big.
All right, yeah. Best ensemble? So far, we only have Bosom Buddies. Is the collection around him, I feel like not really, right? Like, it's not, there's like good performances, but I feel like the ensemble, the collective, is not quite.
No, I feel like we got, even though they weren't as good as, like, these are good actors. Like, that's the thing. They're better actors, but, like, you know, I feel like we got more recognizable faces and stuff like Bachelor Party as, like, a supporting cast, right? With, like, Adrian Tamed and Tawny Kitaen and all them and stuff. Like, no, I mean, you know, it's close, but no cigar.
No, I don't think they're that great just because, like, they're good because Hanks makes them good in his interactions. But, I mean, even the first time you meet any of these characters, like, even when you meet the woman, she's, like, in the office being like, I need you to let me hire somebody else because this person I'm married is, like, an idiot woman who just is getting married and doodling her own name. Like, nobody's likable when you first meet them. It's through their interactions with Tom Hanks that you're like, oh, now I like this person. So I don't think it's a strong ensemble, just they are made good by him.
I like that. I agree with everything you said there. Best fight? There's not really a good fight in this movie, is there?
Well, there's the racquetball or the...
Oh, yeah, that's a pretty good fight.
Does it stack up, Mike, with your 3D fight in Bachelor Party?
Oh, no way. No, so far that for me is the bee's knees. Nothing's going to beat that. Sorry.
Best dance scene, I'm going to say playing the piano in Big. That's a dance scene.
Yeah.
Best party scene? Is there a party here?
That office party. Okay. It's crazy.
Tuxedo-clad office party. Or do we want to nominate that also for best Hank's outfit wardrobe?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, he's got a lot of great shirts and pants and things, like, crazy combos. Like, he does not match until, like, you know, he gets a girlfriend in this movie.
Best death, he does not die. Best line, best freak out. Is there something he says here? Is there, like, a memorable line to Big? I want to be Big, but that's not really...
That's not a good line. There's no good lines in this movie.
Which is, you know, for an Academy Award nominated screenplay, have one cool line.
Yeah, like, and he doesn't really... He only freaks out for a second at the end when he yells at Billy... But Billy, like, comes right back at him, and he's like, fuck you! And, yeah. Like, drops the F-bomb. He's like, I'm still, like, a couple months older than you, asshole, or something. It's great.
Best soundtrack theme? No. Here's an interesting one. Best or worst Hank's love story? Where does this one fall?
I would say the worst. This is probably the worst for everyone involved.
Well, we've got five nominees now, Mike. Here we got Splash, Every Time We Say Goodbye, Bosom Buddies, Nothing in Common, and this movie.
Oh, boy, yeah.
I don't know. Did any of those involve, like, statutory? I don't think so. I think that this goes up there. Like,
it's definitely up there.
It's between this and the mermaid. I guess that's, like, half bestiality. You know, he's having fish sex.
Yeah, but that's international waters, so it's not actually a crime.
Most badass role, no. And then do we want to nominate either Elizabeth Perkins or the kid who plays Billy for best non-Hanks actor, male or female? Is anybody, do we feel strongly about them? Could they stack up with the rest of the, who we're going to see in the rest of Tom Hanks' career?
I don't think they stack up. I think that he's very good, but I don't think that he's like knowing what's to come. I think that they are not going to be that tier, you know?
Yeah. I think, I mean, like, you know, what I say every time, I think, Mike, is that, like, can they compete with, like, Tim Allen, for instance, as Buzz Lightyear? Like, you have to be on that level, and it's tough.
It's tough because I definitely feel what Holly was saying, how, like, Hanks is really, you know, helping, not maybe not helping, but, like, his presence, I feel, is, like, making their other performances stronger in a lot of ways. Like, I like Elizabeth Perkins is, like, doing here, but, like, you know, when they tried to flesh it out in those extra scenes, it was just dismal and horrible and, like, depressing and stuff. And so, like, while she's, like, you know, this successful corporate woman, you know, and all this stuff, and, you know, she's with who she wants, no one's holding her down, all this kind of stuff, like, I just wish there was, like, a little more power to this performance because it's such a really interesting role.
I love this category that you guys have, and, like, I haven't been on a week, because, again, like, I really love these, like, offbeat movies, and this is probably the most mainstream movie I've done with you guys of any of these, you know, groups, but, like, I love this question, but, like, every time I hear it, I'm just like, ah, you're waiting for Sinise. This is gonna go to a Gary Sinise role. Like it'll come, but, like, I just don't think that that's the bar, and I don't know if it's gonna make it, you know?
You're right.
Like, he's hanging, like, Hanks is hanging with, like, Dan Aykroyd, while Cruz is hanging with Dustin Hoffman and stuff, you know, like, and Nicole Kidman. It's just, those are just stronger performances.
Well, Walt, you've got one more Hanks for the Memories in you, and that is the Gary Sinise role in Forrest Gump, so you'll be back for that, and then you'll be on one more Cruise Club for the Cameron Diaz role of a lifetime in Night and Day. So, I mean, I am excited to talk about both of those.
No joke, that's my second favorite Gary Sinise Tom Hanks role. My favorite one is him in Apollo 13. I love that character.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are they... They are back-to-back. Look at that.
Yeah.
And between those roles, between Forrest Gump and Apollo 13, over on the Cruise Club feed, Holly's going to be joining us for The Last Samurai.
Oh, shit.
Because, you know, she is our official Asian correspondent. That's a bad way of saying it. Not the Asian correspondent. How do we want to say this? She's big in Japan.
I'm your friend that lived in Japan for 3 years, so I can maybe speak to it.
Our consultant.
And then, Holly, you'll be back for two more Lost at Sea movies, essentially, in Castaway and then also Captain Phillips. Like, you have,
oh, wow.
You have a nautical theme going on with you.
I will gladly come and speak about any movie you want me to, whether I love it or hate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate both of you stopping by and talking about Big. We are now all allowed to get little again. We no longer have to be big, so I just have to find a Zoltar machine and get us shrink down. But thank you both so much.
Oh, thanks for having. This is a lot of fun. I really really appreciate the coming on. Like, this is a fun movie. It's always like really, really great to go through this kind of stuff with you guys. It's a really fun podcast.
Yeah, I'm now gonna try and make plans to find a summer carnival and not wish myself out of my current
like, yo, quick question. If you got banged, like hypothetically, like let's say that you got like body swap, whatever you want to call it. Let's say that you look different than you look now, and you had to go to your best friend. What would you tell them to try to convince them that you were you?
I would talk about all of our stupid anime crushes, because when I was, let's be real, still slightly currently, I was very big into anime and, like, handsome Bishonen cartoon characters. So really just, like, two or three good confessions, she would know it was me.
I was also going to say anime. I was going to refer to Yuri on Ice. That would get the job done.
I would, I'd probably go over to Joey and list every single Nick Cage movie chronologically. And he'd be like, well, this can only be one person.
It's Lindsay Gibb. It's got to be Lindsay Gibb.
No. It could be Austin Both Southern at this point.
I think it depends on who it would be, but I think something maybe Nicolas Cage related, I think, would probably get the job done. Or more recently, you know, Fast and Furious, something like if I had to convince. Mm-hmm. Joe too. I guess it's something to be, you know, for you, Mike, I think it'd be probably, you know, Nicolas Cage. For Joe too, be Fast and Furious. Like, for other people, it'd be different things. But I think something, again, I guess there's a reason we're all talking about movies tonight, is that pop culture drives the passions and the things, the relationships that we have. So whether you're talking about anime or Nicolas Cage or whatever, that's how you get the job done.
Yeah.
I like that. That's a good question, though. Thank you, Walt.
Yeah.
For all things Hanks for the Memories, including Walt's episode of Hanks for the Memories Volunteers, and then also the cruise club that he was on, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, hanks@cageclub.me. Check out our Threadless shop and our Patreon page, and come back in 2 weeks for Punchline. And then check out next week on the Cruise Club, A Few Good Men, starring the Golden Globe-nominated Best Actor, Tom Cruise. I'm going to get in every plug of that I possibly can, Mike, so I never forget those again. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Holly Gore and Walt Hickey, and we'll see you next time on Hanks for the Memories.
This is the coolest thing I've ever seen!